So welcome everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm sort of at the recovery stage of bronchitis, so that's why I've kind of wired a little bit tonight. I want to share with you tonight some very meaningful, profound teachings from Thich Nhat Hanh. But before we get into the formal teachings tonight, does anybody have any questions about practice, their own practice, that needs to be looked at? Everybody's clear, satisfied, good. Yes, one person's not. There's always one, you know.
Last week, Brian led us in a discussion that was really lovely about watering seeds in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition and watering the positive seeds and not watering the seeds that are negative and cause suffering. And a question was asked, well, and Brian shared Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching that when negative seeds come up, you know, whether it's anger or some other affliction, that Thich Nhat Hanh tells us we should embrace those, not try to push them away, but almost like we'd embrace a baby. And the question came up from someone in the Sangha of, how do you really do that practically? You know, when something negative comes up, you know, how do I take care of that in the seed watering context? And we talked a little bit about that, but I thought it would be helpful to ask you that question as well.
Good. Again, let me just give a brief answer. I mean, that's a whole talk in and of itself, but I did want to share some of these with you tonight. Right, so obviously the reason we practice is because of the negative side of life. I mean, nobody practices meditation, Dharma, Buddhism, or spiritual path because they are totally happy and satisfied in their life, right? So there's obviously, we feel a need for a transformative healing path, a spiritual path, because of suffering. All types of suffering that exists within us or in relationships or in the world, in those we love and care about, and of the various kinds of sufferings, and there are many, many kinds of sufferings, what might be called emotional afflictions, or these kind of negative mind states, are obviously very prevalent. They bring disturbance to our own minds, our capacity to be peaceful, calm, to be loving, to be kind, to be compassionate, you know, patient, all the virtues that we want to cultivate through a spiritual path immediately, if not sooner, disappear when our minds are taken over by negative emotions and afflictions. Now, the problem is, before we have a spiritual practice or a way of dealing with these things, they usually almost cause us to act out. So we act out. We act out if we're angry. We act out to the person who we believe made us angry. If we're having other kinds of negative emotions or feelings, we often act out in compulsive ways. We act out in addictive ways. We act out in other kinds of ways. Anything but taking responsibility that this emotional affliction, this negative mood, whatever we want to call it, right, is arising where? In me. I mean, if there is one salient point of all of this, is what? That I no longer externalize, I no longer blame, I no longer see the cause of my suffering, in this case emotional afflictions, as being outside myself. I'm clearly aware of what? That if a negative mood or mind state has arisen, it's arisen where? In my mind, right? And nobody has the power to get into my mind and make me think or feel a certain way. Even though in our moments when we're taken over, we do blame others. You know, you're making me feel this way. If this person didn't do that or didn't do this, I wouldn't be feeling this way. But the truth is, that's nonsense, right? Because whatever they've done or didn't do, it's happened external, right? And the feeling and the thought is occurring within our own mind stream. Right? So this is almost a defining moment, I think, in somebody seriously practicing a spiritual path, is that we no longer externalize experience, we no longer hold those outside or situations outside for what we're experiencing, but we take full responsibility for it. Right? Okay. Now, you know, now we have great capacity, don't we, for doing something significant, right? In the same way, as long as, you know, we blame everybody else for our health problems and never look to our own consumption patterns, eating patterns, exercise patterns, you know what I mean, all kinds of stuff, we don't fully understand our own capability for health and well-being. It doesn't mean there isn't disease or other things, but we certainly acknowledge that each of us have great capacity for health and well-being in our body when we take responsibility. You know, if we don't take responsibility, then whether we exercise or don't exercise, what we eat, don't eat, what we consume, don't consume, etc., you know, our moods or something, have no relationship to our well-being of our body. But once we understand that, there's a shift, right? In the same way with our minds. So, making that radical shift, which I no longer externalize, I take full responsibility for what is arising in my mind. Now, when these things arise, irritation arises, frustration arises, resentment arises, anger arises, anxiety arises, worry arises, fear arises, sadness arises, loss and grief and depression, you know, all these things arise. They are rising in my mind because of causes and conditions that are, or seeds, that have grown in my own mind. Okay? Now, before I have a practice, they come up, they take me over, and I just act out in the way I've always acted out in the myriad internal or external ways. But once I have learned a more productive, transformative way to heal them, to heal them, to take care of them, I act differently. So what does that mean? First step is what? First step is mindfulness. Mindfulness of what? Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of thoughts, mindfulness of feelings. Right? In other words, I have to know what's going on inside me. If I don't know, if I can't name it, how am I going to take responsibility for it, you see? So mindfulness is that light that lights up our experience, right? In other words, I am aware that I am what? Angry. I'm aware that I'm fearful. I'm aware that I'm worried. I'm aware that I'm resentful. I'm aware that I'm jealous, right? All in all in all. But I am acknowledging that these feelings or mind states or thoughts are present within me. Okay. So that's step one. Because you can't work with it until you acknowledge it, until you know something's present, right? In other words, if I come in this room and it's pitch black and I hear sounds or scurrying about, I don't know what's really going on, do I? The only way I can really know is to turn on the light. Once I turn the light, I see what's going on and then I can deal with it. Right, up to then, it's all imagination. Right, so mindfulness is that light that lights up and tells us what's going on in our body, mind. Right? Now, I think the teaching you're referring to is the first thing we do is rather than acting out, and a lot of the acting out is because we are not, many people aren't comfortable with negative feelings. They right away want to discharge them. But these are, they're just feelings. That's all they are. There are good feelings in the body, happiness, joy, pleasure, and there are negative feelings in the body, right? That according to cause and conditions arise. One has to be able to have an objective, neutral capacity to be present to whatever is arising in one's mind, right? So, first step is there's awareness of the mind state that has arisen, and the second step is we hold it. Breathing in, I'm aware there is anxiety in me. Breathing in, I'm aware there's resentment in me. You know what I mean? Like that. And then breathing out, what? I calm, which is usually the opposite of what we do, right? When we have a little afflictive negative emotion in us, we immediately what? Let's see how much play I can get out of this. Right, let's see how I can ramp it up, right? You know, irritation, frustration, why not go for anger? You know, I'll just keep repeating the scenario over my head. I'm a little worried, right? Why don't I keep playing and really work myself up into a full-blown anxiety attack, right? Why waste a good afflictive emotion? You know, I mean, I'm angry at somebody, why don't I tell them what I really think of them, right? You know, just let them have it, right? You see what I'm saying? So that historical way we have of intensifying, right, affliction, we need to put an end to. Right? So how do we do it? Our mindfulness reveals the thoughts, feelings, perceptions that are inside us. They reveal to us that a negative affliction has arisen. And now, because we've developed some capacity of awareness, we hold it. We don't do anything. We breathe with it. And we calm it. And then when it is calmed, then we look deeply into it. All right? Because maybe there is something, you know, in the reality of whatever situation produces emotional affliction, it needs looking into. Right? I mean, maybe there is something I'm worried about, that when I look deeply into it, I may go, it's just nonsense, there's nothing to worry about, or it's far in the future. Or else you say, well, no, this is something that I need to take care of, right? So you take care of it, right? Or there's a resentment or an anger that you have with somebody, and you may look at it and say, yeah, there is some kind of misunderstanding between us, or something hurtful that passed. You know, I need to talk to that person about it, right? But not when I'm angry, and not when the hurt is strong in me, not when the resentment is strong in me, right? Because then it'll just produce more suffering. So this capacity to be mindful and to name, to hold and to calm, and then to look deeply into the cause and conditions that have brought this into arousal within the mind, and to see if there's really, you know, a lot of times we'll just let it go because we realize we've just blown it all out, or we'll see we maybe misinterpreted, or we overreacted or something. But sometimes, again, you know, that's a real situation that needs to be dealt with. But now at least we're not dealing from that place of emotional affliction, which only makes a meaningful response to the situation more difficult. Is that clear? So, is, you know, taking responsibility for one's emotions does not mean that, you know, one doesn't interact, one, you know, one isn't involved in life, colleagues, work, family, friends, and the course of life, conflicts, misunderstandings, etc., don't occur. But now we're dealing with them in, I would say it, a much more mature way, right? Because when we are in the throes of emotional afflictions, when we are in the throes of skewed and distorted perceptions, right? Which is usually means when we're totally in the realm of our own self-righteousness, right? I'm right, you're wrong. I'm good, you're bad, right? You know that one. You know, nothing meaningful can come out of that. It's only when we have the capacity of acknowledging, you know, what's going on with us, but equally willing to acknowledge what's going on with the other. Equally willing to see their point of view as well as my point of view. You know, then resolution and reconciliation can take place. But when we're in the throes of our emotionality, when we're in the throes of our blame, when we're in the throes of self-righteousness and egocentricity, nothing good will come of that. Does anybody disagree with me? Anybody think that being in the throes of egocentricity and self-righteousness and emotional affliction only makes life better? See, we laugh, right? Because here we are, and we're somewhat rational, you know, and we're somewhat removed from life, and we go, of course, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And yet, in our real life, we do carry on that way, don't we? Several months ago, someone gave me a gift of this book. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. I don't know if it's, you know, calligraphy. So I don't know if this is calligraphic or calligraphic. Calligraphic meditation. But anyhow, it's called calligraphic or calligraphic meditation, The Mindful Art of Thich Nhat Hanh. And basically, somebody organized at the University of Hong Kong an exhibit of his calligraphy. Several years ago, and this must have been like the book that went with the exhibit. So it's now been issued. And to me, these are what we might call, or I would call, pith teachings. If you know Buddhism, you know there are many, many teachings, many, many quite elaborate teachings. A pith teaching, it refers to pit. You know, the pit or the seed is very small. But like, the seed of the oak tree, the pit, the seed of the oak tree contains the oak tree, is the oak tree. It's all there, you know, it's all in the DNA. It's just waiting for the right conditions. So in Buddhism, as probably other traditions, are what they call these pith teachings. They're very small, but they're very powerful and encapsulate lots of meaning. I'd say some of them are also like mantras. You know, mantras are usually thought of as Sanskrit syllables that have power, for achieving their various kinds of mantras, for achieving various ends. To me, these are like mantras. They're very short words, but they can be repeated over and over again, and they have great power for liberation. They have great power for freedom. So this is a book full of them. As you can see, I have many markers here. I started going through them, thinking which ones I want to teach, and before I know it, I had marked most of them. So this is one of my favorite mantras, pith teachings. If you put this into practice, I think you will reduce your suffering at least by 50%. Can everybody see this? Bill, can you read this?
Yes.
What does it say?
Are you sure?
Are you sure? Are you sure? The way this is practiced, it's actually practiced as, am I sure? Now, what does this refer to? Pretty much everything. But certainly refers to the world of our thoughts and perceptions, right? Because usually when we have a strong perception or thought, we think what? We are right. We're right. I mean, that's right. We are right. Of course, the problem with when we're right, then everybody else or the other person has to be what? Wrong. Right? I mean, because this is the world of relativity. Right, being right can't exist without being somebody being wrong. Right? So if I am right, then you must be wrong. If my thoughts are true, then your thoughts may be false. If my perceptions are correct, then your perceptions must be incorrect. Right? If my political beliefs are absolutely true, then yours must be absolutely false. Right? So you can see that whether this is just in a very personal way, which means just the way I think about myself. Right? Like maybe I think I'm the greatest person there is, right? Or perhaps I think I'm the worst person, right? But once you add, are you sure? Then there's what? If I'm the greatest or the worst, those are absolutes, right? There's no given there, is there? There's no flexibility, there's no adaptability. But once you add, am I sure, things open, don't they? I could be wrong, right? So in a certain way, what we're talking about is when you think about geometry, for those of you who still remember geometry, there are these things called theorems and these things called hypotheses. A theorem is what?
Proven.
It's proven. Okay? Right. Remember? And hypothesis is what?
Questions.
It could be true, it could be not true, but it has to be proven. What are you sure does? It takes the world of thought, of perceptions, of belief, and turns everything into what? Hypothesis. Which softens, right? Which allows room for what? Other ways of looking at things, right? You know, I think the way I see the situation is true for me, but how do you see it, you know? I mean, I think, you know, I mean, if can you imagine if they did this In you know, since we're in the middle of a presidential whatever, you know, I mean, wouldn't it be incredible if these politicians, I mean, is there any politician who practices this? They practice what? I mean, they do the opposite, right? I'm totally right and everybody else is a complete idiot or a traitor or a communist or, you know what I mean? Or it's right, nobody's going... You know, to be honest with you, you know, this is what I think would be best for the country, but I'm certainly interested in hearing from other people because I may not be right. I mean, can you imagine if a politician talked that way? You know? Which sounds so logical. I mean, these are big issues. You'd think you'd want to be open and get lots of different opinions and viewpoints. Are you sure? Am I sure? Am I sure that my story about who I was in the past is true? Am I sure my thoughts about myself are true? Are my worries and my fantasies about the future, am I sure they're true? The way I think about this person or that person, my judgment about this and that, am I sure? Then it's true. Once you begin to add this, again, it doesn't say you're false. Do you see what I'm saying? It doesn't say that you can't have perceptions, you can't have beliefs, but that absolute nature is removed. And all of a sudden there's openness. And when there's openness, there's the capacity to what? To connect with other people, right? That you may see things different then. Because you're now, you know, you're coming from a place which says, you know, I'm interested in how you see it. You know, that's interesting, right? God, I experience it this way. And you, well, that's fascinating that you experience that way. I never thought of that. You see, there's kind of openness. And learning takes place in openness. Creativity takes place in openness. New possibilities take place in openness. You know, if we're sure. Because again, if you think about being sure about something, where do we get this sense of surety from? Well, from the past. I mean, these are the belief systems, the thoughts, perceptions that we've built up over time that we're coming into the present thinking that this is right. So there's no possibility for change if I'm sure. I'm absolutely right. But I'm not absolutely right. Sometimes in life, you know, we're in positions of responsibility. We're parents, we're supervisors, we're this or that, where we have to make decisions. We have to make choices, right? But again, to make them with that sense of responsibility, but knowing, well, I'm just, you know, I mean, you know, it may be more than a best guess. Right? But based on the information I have and everything else, this is what seems right to me at the time. This seems the best way to proceed. Am I 100% right and sure? No. But we don't have to be, do we? Because we really can't be sure. Why? Because we are not clairvoyant. Right? We don't know what the outcome will be. Right? All we know is this seems to be, based on this and this, the decision that may produce the outcome desired, right? But am I sure? 100% sure? Absolutely not. Great mantra. Am I sure? Or to ask somebody else, are you sure? I mean, 100% sure that this is going to happen, just the way you think it'll happen. We like to think we're going to live happily ever after, right? Are you sure? We'd like to think we're going to live to a ripe old age. Are you sure? We think we're going to make it home tonight in one piece. Are you 100% sure? And all of a sudden you realize what? No. No. There's really no absolute surety. And that's okay. Right. That's okay. It makes life what it is. Interesting. Any questions about are you sure? So please, please take this mantra home with you, and you could write it, post it on your forehead, on the fridge. Or am I sure? That can just be, you know, nobody has to hear it. It can be something you say under your breath. Am I sure? About anything. Yes.
I had a question about the are you sure thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in your mind you tend to sort of prioritize things that you feel more sure about something to you about others.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think to yourself, okay, I feel safe or I feel good that I feel more sure about, okay, I won't get into an accident on the way home, for example. you might be unsure about some other thing, like, oh, when am I going to go grocery shopping this weekend? So that, but that's not as important. So I get confused because how do you reconcile?
Well, I think you have the answer. Because so obviously.
How do you reconcile that with, like, the whole world? Are you sure that something's wrong?
But you see.
Your mind picks and chooses.
I know the mind picks and chooses. But again, to understand that it's all conditional. That even your sureness, right, that you're going to go shopping at a certain time this weekend may or may not work out that way, right? If you think it's not an hypothesis, but you think it's a truth, then if it doesn't work out that way, how are you going to feel? Right?
Yeah.
Frustrated, disappointed, right? Because I was planning, you know. But if you know it's not sure, or again, something bigger, you know, something more important in your life that you're pretty sure about. I was talking to me the other day who made a career choice that they were sure about. But they weren't so sure now that they're doing this. Right? Because again, the truth is we don't know, do we? We don't know anything. Now, see, that can be scary for people because you think, I got to know everything. I got to have everything lined up, everything. But the world doesn't work that way. Why? Because the world is not solid. The world is impermanent. Everything is changing all the time. There are so many variables in this life that are always interacting. Surety, absolute surety is a myth. Right? And the problem is, if you believe your choices are certain and things will turn out exactly the way, then it's a setup for suffering. Because when they don't, you are going to be frustrated, disappointment, resentful, hurt, scared. All those things will come up. But if you understand that even your the things you feel very strong and decisive about are really conditional, and subject to change and other variables which you may not be aware of. Right? But can you see if you have that kind of view, then you become a very adaptable person. See, people who live in the surety are rigid. So when they come up against things not working out the way they want, they get what? Frustrated, angry. They dig in their heels, or you know what I'm saying? So this "Are you sure?" creates a person who goes with the flow, who knows the direction, but can curve a little bit this way, curve a little bit that way, works with situations creatively. Because they know, nothing is sure. Right? Yeah. So you want to have a view of life that is correct. In Buddhism, that's called right view, right thought. If you're going to have thoughts, if you're going to have views about things, you want things that are in accord with reality, right? Because if you have a view that says, if I think it, it must be true, if I think it, it must be true. That's very dangerous. Because the mind is capable of thinking anything, right? It's quite capable of thinking things that are completely opposite. Within 15 minutes it can change, right? You think somebody's angry at you, you run into them, they say, "Hi, Fred, how you doing?" Now I really like them again. Right? So this mind is very fickle, not something to be trusted. So we want to have a view that's correct. Another great mantra, another pith teaching. Bill.
This is it.
This is it. So are you sure? Am I sure? Has a lot to do with the world of thought, the world of relationship, the world of perception, the world of belief. Really, it's a great mantra to take into the world. This is it, tells us how to be in the world. You see, it's strong. This is it. Now, what is this? Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, that is the this. Okay? This is whatever you're doing in the moment, the reality of your life. That is this. It means what? There's nothing else. There's nothing else. So in truth, we could say, so what does this mean? This is it. For example, there are 25, 30 people in this room, right? Everybody, has a different life here, right? We live in different places, we have different jobs, we have different thoughts, we have different belief systems, right? Right? 30 very unique individuals are here. But you know what? For all of us, for some bizarre reason, in this moment, this is it for us. For everybody. Right? We are here. And our life that we believe is waiting for us is just a what? A thought, a memory, a fantasy. Right? Because in truth, the only real thing is this. Right? Right? Where are you alive? You're alive right now. I mean, we're not alive somewhere else. Does anybody think they have other kind of psychic bodies they're sending out that are doing things right this moment? No. Each of us are alive in only one place. Here and now. This is our life. When we get up and we walk out, that will be it. We get in our car, that will be it. But not until we're doing it. Right? Otherwise, it's all fantasy. We think we're going to make it home tonight. We think it's going to be like this, but we don't know. The only thing we know is this is it. Is that clear? This is a profound key teaching of this path. One, because it reveals to us where life really is. Here and now. This is it. Now, the important implications of this is not only, so what are the implications of this? If I understand this is it, then people who tend to, many people live in the past. They spend a lot of time thinking about, ruminating about past, going over the past, just kind of reliving the past, going over the past in terms of regrets or things they wish they had done differently or done, right? But a lot of people spend a lot of time in the past. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who spend a lot of time in the future, fantasizing about it, worrying about it, planning for it, always having expectations about it, going somewhere, they're thinking about it. Okay. The truth is what? None of that is real. That's all just thought. The only thing that is real is this moment. So when you live by this and is it, you are no longer spending so much of your energy mulling over the past, fantasizing about the future, planning, ruminating, reliving, all that stuff. cleared out. So now you have the capacity of what? Of truly being present to your life. Again, where is your life occurring? Now. It's not occurring anywhere else. So if you want to be happy, you have to be happy when? Now. If you want to be peaceful, when are you going to be peaceful? Now. If you want to be a kind, compassionate human being, when are you going to do it? Now. But most of us, you know, we kind of like, don't put much, into now, and we're always thinking about, you know, we read and we talk about and how we want to be a compassionate person, we want to be a more peaceful person, we want to be a nicer human being, a kinder human being, a more patient, right? When are you going to do it? There's only one place to do it. There's only one place to change. And when is that? Now. You're always going to change in the now. Aren't you? Everything else is a fantasy. You know, you may think about, I'm going to change and become like this and become like that, or stop doing this or stop doing that. But at some point, you're going to have to do it. And when you do it, you're going to be doing it now. There's nowhere else to do it. So why don't you do it now? Right? This, because this is it. What are you waiting for? This is it. This is your life. You want to be happy? You want to be a happy person? It's now. You want to lead a meaningful life? It's now. You want to lead a purposeful life? Do it now. I mean, when are you going to do it? And that now is wherever you are. It's not like now is, 8:35 at the UU Church in a meditation hall. Now is wherever you are. You're at work, you're at home, you're shopping, whatever you're doing. That's now. When are you going to live in the moment? Now. There's no other time. See? There's a man who knows the now. So again, this is very simple, but it's a pith teaching. There's lots of meaning in it. Are there any questions? Think about it. I mean, this is it. You may have to repeat this every 5 minutes. Because why? Because the mind is so used to just traveling all over the place. Traveling the past, traveling the future. Always thinking, life begins, or I'll do this when, or when this comes together and that comes together. But are you sure it's going to really unfold that way? Remember, are you sure? Are you sure? And when we ask ourselves that, we can say, no, I'm not sure. The only thing is I'm sure of is what? Yeah. That right now, in this moment, I am alive. And if there's something I want to do with my life, there's a way I want to be, the only thing I know is I have maybe some ability to do it now. Otherwise, I'm hoping, planning, right? It may turn out that way, but it may not. funny, I lived in a place called Naples, Florida for 25 years. And people know Naples, Florida. It's very much a retirement community, resort community, a lot of a lot of retired executives, and a lot of that. And it was interesting because many of these people had scripts. Work hard, make a lot of money, retire to a beautiful gated golf community in Naples, and then what? And then live the good life, right? Because I've earned it and deserved it. That was the plan. But then things happen. You know, you age. You have a stroke. You have a heart attack. You have arthritis. You know what I'm saying? You know, or you die, but that's like, I'm not even going there. And all of a sudden, it's like people would be, you know, really angry or depressed because it wasn't supposed to be this way, right? Right? Because they had a plan. But, this is it. And our plans for how our life is going to unfold are just that. They're made up. They're best guesses. They're hypotheses. Right? And I think it's much better to be grounded in reality and learn to live with comfort and ease and meaning in the present, in the now, rather than at some future time. Any questions about this? Yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
Your Naples example takes a really long and from what I do, I have seen that, and many people will be very disappointed. They work very hard to enjoy some time in future, and it gets snatched away in some way. On the other hand, if you are talking to a little younger generation that's still building their life, What is it for them? Because when we have children as parents, they want to go and play and just enjoy, but we tell them, no, there it is to suffer a little, not do what they want or enjoy, but maybe study, maybe not sleep that much, maybe take some suffering for a little better future. So when you take a short, or that can be applied to a certain later level, where you're building your career, doing something. So when you take a shorter view, where you're building, and sometimes your it is not enjoying
it. Yeah.
But taking some calculated suffering to build, how do you explain that?
Well, again, that's a good question. So I'm just, repeating it for the microphone. So the question is, different stages of life demand different kind of endeavors, and it is not always a happy it. It can be a difficult it, or etc. And you're absolutely right. So that is why this is it has no emotional coloration at all. Okay. That is the wonder of it. It really, another way to look at this is it, is to say, if there is no past or future, not that we, as human beings, in our life cycle don't plan, go through developmental stages, but the idea that somehow it will turn out exactly the way we expect it, again, takes that rigidity out of it. This is it means whatever is right in front of me, I am 100% involved in. Okay. Because this is it. So if I am in, if I'm in an apprenticeship, if I'm in, a, if I'm in school, if I'm in graduate school, if I'm in some sort of training capacity, you know, that's part of a future date. But what it means is, whatever it is right now, I am 100% in it. I am not resenting it. I am not diminishing it. You know, because in Zen, you know, the Zen training is very interesting. In Zen training, in traditional monastic training, you know, you may be, you know, for 6 months you're rotated, but you may be sweeping, cleaning, raking. You may be working in the kitchen. You may be the abbot. But whatever you are, you're doing 100%. You're not diminishing anything you're doing, saying, oh, this is lower work, or, you know what I'm saying? Because the truth is, when we are 100% present to whatever we're doing and involved, it becomes a meaningful moment. And what we want to be able to do is to be able to live our life where, whether I'm saving somebody who's got a heart attack, or whether I'm washing the dishes, I am as involved and present, right? I'm not saying this is right, you know, this is important. It's like everything I do in life is important, because everything I do in life, I give my total attention to, right? It's a way of living. Right. So it's you know, whether I'm at the end of my life, whether in the beginning of my life, whatever I am 100% there. Does that make sense? And again, you know, we may be in a process because we want an end result. But if it's only about the end result, we may diminish and resent what's going on in the present. Or we may always be fantasizing about some future event or what we're doing, which only causes what? Suffering. Again, remember, the Buddhist teaching is all about only one thing. The Buddha said, I teach one thing, cessation of suffering. I mean, that's what he said. He said, that's all I do. And so, in that sense, any kind of mind state that causes any kind of affliction is suffering. It's not a big type suffering, but it's suffering. So you want to be able to live your life where wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you are wholly present to it, valuing it. Why do you value it? Because this is it, right? You might be saying, well, I'm just taking a course now and doing this Mickey Mouse stuff and this Mickey Mouse stuff, but one day I'll be great, you know. But you don't know if you'll ever get there. And you don't know when you get there whether you'll really like it, or whether that may not turn out to be a source of suffering for you, right? You don't know. All you know is what? In this moment, this is my life, and if I want to be happy, if I want to be fulfilled, then I need to be 100% present to it. Does that explain it? Yeah, so that's important. Because it's not absolute, right? Because obviously in this life, right, like when you're young and you're going to, you know, have a career or have a family or thing, you know, you have to do some future planning. We have to do, if we're going to take vacation this summer, we do some future planning. You know, so we can enter the world of planning and enter future, but knowing that it's just a hypothesis. It may not turn out that way, right? How will I know? Because when the future becomes the present, which means it's real, then I'll know what it's like. And it may be very different than I thought. So that's again why, you know, a lot of people, they're always having expectations. They're going somewhere and they have lots of expectations of how it's going to be and who's going to say what. But that's not a way to live, right? Because then that moment isn't free. That moment doesn't have the capability of being totally alive. Because already we have a conception, a picture of how it's supposed to be. Can you see which limits it? Why not just show up? See what happens. Have no expectations at all. You know, if you have no expectations, everything is interesting. Yeah, everything is interesting. It's kind of wonderful that way. You never know how things are going to unfold. So life becomes much more alive without expectations. So good. I think it's time to end. So, what?
A request.
Oh.
We are practicing together as a community.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us will be here next week.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd like to have some instruction from you based on these wonderful teachings tonight. Can you just give us a few suggestions for how we might practice during the week with some of what you taught us, and then would ask the Sangha that when we gather next week at the beginning of our discussion teaching, that we'll spend a little bit of time talking about how we practiced over the week. And we're doing this because we love your talks, they're interesting, they're often entertaining, and then we don't want to go home and forget about it. So we're hoping that if we have a little inspiration for practice, like reporting next week, that we can practice this together as a Sangha. So could you just give us
This is easy. So the first thing would be our discussion about how to handle negative emotions. So please, please do your best this week to be very aware of your mind states. And when you're aware that there's a negative emotion, again, negative emotion means what? Emotions that disturb your equanimity, disturb your calmness, disturb your harmony, right? This is a negative affliction. And you know, so when you're angry, resentful, frustrated, scared, worried, sad, depressed, you know, all those kinds of things disturb your equanimity. So if you're experiencing, again, please put into effect what we talked about, which is learning not to act out in any way, but to hold the feeling, hold the mind state in mindfulness, to soothe it and calm it, and then to look deeply into causation, right? What's causing this to arise within me? So I'd say that'd be one practice to do in terms of emotions. And then, you know, are you sure? Am I sure? Just, you know, every time you have a strong statement, a perception about yourself, about anything, just add, am I sure? Ask yourself that question. Am I absolutely sure? And then the third is, this is it. Keep reminding yourself. This is it. This is my life, right here, whatever I'm doing. Brushing my teeth, going to the bathroom, talking to somebody, talking on the phone to somebody, doing my work, wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, can I be 100% present? Because why? Because this is it. This is my life. It's unfolding in the now. Can I be present to it? Three good practices. Good. Thank you.